You're back with RCR and our Power Talks with Don and Jaspreet, and we have Larry Blair back in the house tonight to talk about things energy part two. Welcome back, Larry, and you've been a prolifically writing recently on your Substack, New Zealand Energy, and many of those articles resonate with me. But here we are, this little island nation in the bottom of this or mid-South Pacific. We're an isolated sort of chunk of dirt, effectively, and we've got plenty of energy options available to us. But we constantly hear this refrain that we've got to have renewable energy. And specifically, it seems to be it doesn't matter whether it's hydro anymore. No, it's got to be wind or solar. And that seems to be the big deal. Now, in the South recently, we've had a major project turned down by the courts, Environment Court. I think it's the Environment Court. Anyway, it was a Contact Energy slope down site, and they were going to put towers that had, I think, to the tip of their blade in their highest position to the ground was 220 meters. So it was big, and people talked about the vista being altered. Others talked about biodiversity being altered. So here we are. We want all this stuff. We want all this wind and solar, apparently. But now it's almost too hard to get through the hoops of the planning procedure. My point is, and you've written an article, a very good article on March the 5th called Market Guardrails. And I read that intensively and I thought, yeah, we are fixated on these two things, wind and solar, and it's at our peril, really. Comments from you, Larry. Sorry for that long-winded intro.
No, that's great, Don. It's nice to be back. So thanks for having me. Yeah, so I saw that the Southland Wind Farm hadn't got its consent. I understand it was due to wetland areas or something like that. So yeah, it's interesting. I've often lamented the fact that we can't really build anything in this country anymore, and that the RMA definitely does need a massive overhaul if we're going to solve any of these problems. That's one of the major barriers at the moment. It's not fit for purpose. I think that's pretty widely agreed on. So that's not too contentious. And that article I wrote on market guardrails, what I was trying to say there is that there's only really two criteria that we assess the energy market by, and or sorry, any infrastructure we want to add to the energy market, and one is it's got to be renewables, and two, the market will fix all problems, right? So we don't really need to think about what the mix of the power is, because the market will sort that out. The market's this magic thing that will solve all problems. So that was the thrust of that argument, and basically what I was trying to say there is that that wind in itself has a significant problem in that the wind's pretty consistent across the whole country at pretty much the same time. And I put a few graphs up there and stuff like that. You could see where there's holes in the generating profile between the North and South Island on over a, I think there was a period of about 5 days there that I had in April. It looked pretty much identical. There was very little difference there. So it didn't matter that you had these sites geographically located across the length of the country. They were all seeing the same fronts. They're all seeing the same highs. And then basically you were either feast or famine. So it made it really hard for the wind operators. So the only people at the moment that are sort of pursuing the wind with any sort of vigor are the bigger gentailers at the moment that are able to supplement it with their hydro scheme. So basically you're putting wind in, and that allows you to store more water in the lake. So you can bias towards the wind when the wind's blowing, and when the wind's not blowing, you go back to your hydro. Sounds really good in theory, but again, it's eroding some of the efficiency of the hydro scheme, and it's increasing the cost base of that gentailer's operation, right? So it actually adds cost, although it might add a little bit of storage over, in the bigger scheme of things, it's making the system more complex and adding more infrastructure to it for little marginal gain.
You think that's almost desired by the players because it strikes me that it is they almost taking the hardest way to supply us.
Yeah, well, I mean, but again, it's these guardrails, right? It's like we don't go, what is the minimum criteria for this any power we want to add to the grid, right? And what we're doing is we're building more and more intermittency into the grid, and we're having less and less firm power, dispatchable power, you know, things that you can turn on and turn off as required. You can modulate to follow load, all that sort of stuff. There's less and less of that there. And more of this intermittent stuff. So we're getting in a really interesting spot where the fragility in the system is increasing quite dramatically because, you know, we're increasingly dependent on Huntly. Huntly's an old plant. There were some decisions made a few years ago that coal was going to be phased out, so there wasn't a lot of maintenance done on the coal-fired Raken units part of it. I think they'd even decommissioned one or two of them from memory. And then they've obviously had to put those back into service, and more we're dependent on coal. I mean, coal's at a 3-year high at the moment, coal usage. So you can see where it's going, right? Like it's moving more towards we need more and more of that firming capacity to match up with this intermittency. And the intermittency isn't really, the intermittent power's not delivering value for us when we've got low hydro levels as well, right? So, and all it's really doing is just creating a bigger, more complicated system that's got more single failure points in it.
Well, you are
Yeah,
referring to
so
the
none of this.
fragility.
Sorry, carry on, Jaspreet.
You use the word, Larry, frail, that we are making the energy system frail. Yet the statement that came from the powers that be when the slope-down wind farm was rejected, and I quote, is a major blow to New Zealand's energy security. Not approval of this wind farm is called as a blow to energy security. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends which lens you put on it, right? If you consider
Yes.
energy security is putting a bit more, having a bit more hydro reserve that you're offsetting with wind, then maybe. But overall, I think it would add next to nothing to the overall security of the grid. And if anything, it probably compromises it in some ways just by adding complexity, right?
Yeah, indeed.
Well, at the moment, you've written in your Substack that currently there's 1,400 megawatts of wind generation capacity in New Zealand. Obviously, with the slope down being built, it would have added a little bit more. But total demand for electricity from all sources is between 3,000 and 4,000 megawatts. So, and when you have explained it to us in the past that the output from the wind is nothing like its nameplate, it's more like between sort of 35 and 40%, I gather. So really, wind is still a very small component of our total mix, as I understand it. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I'm sitting here this evening and I think we've got about 4.5% of the generations coming from wind. So I might have my numbers slightly wrong, and it's closer to 1200 megawatts, 1200 megawatts of installed wind capacity, but it's generating just over 200 megawatts tonight, right? So the difference between the amount installed and the amount it generates on average is called the capacity factor. So onshore wind, you're probably looking at a capacity factor on average around 30 to 35% at best, I would think. Yeah, some sites it's down to 20. Some maybe do a little slightly better, but yeah.
And so I just want to reiterate that in your Substack, you also show that the wind drop-off is quite sudden in a lot of zones. And generally, it's the whole country at once almost. It's effectively the wind is going all guns blazing. And we know how it works on the South Coast, that's for sure. And all of a sudden, within a space of half an hour, the wind has dropped right away. And that's a significant problem to balance the grid, isn't it?
Yeah, so that, I mean, it creates a couple of problems. One's just matching the grid phase. The hertz that it runs at has to be very, very, there's very low tolerances in that, and having wind that's coming in and out rapidly can affect that. And also, it's just, you know, if you've got 400 megawatts of wind in that example I put in the article that drops out suddenly, that's 400 megawatts you've got to find somewhere else that you can ramp up suddenly, which is, If you've got some backup hydro you can dispatch, then that's great. If otherwise, you've got to start shoveling coal really fast. Ideally, it's gas, right? Gas is where we're used to, because a gas turbine can respond quite fast.
And we don't seem to be worried anymore what we are doing here. Don, I think there's a bit of a lag tonight, isn't it, between the internet?
There's certainly a bad lag. Sorry to our viewers and listeners. Can't change that, but we'll box on. Interestingly, you're also right in your article that there's going to be a review. I think Frontier is the consultancy that's going to do the market review. You're a bit cynical about it, but you did suggest that in the end, there may be some sweeteners like they have in foreign countries like the UK or Europe, contracts for difference or curtailment pricing. What exactly are they, and why would they be a sweetener?
Well, yeah, it's to deal with the intermittency problem, right? So one of the, I guess if you approach a review with a preconceived idea that we need to harness more wind in New Zealand, right? So that's the first thing, right? So you go into your review and you think that the solution is that we need to have more wind. Then the immediate problem you run into is that, as we've just discussed, the wind is pretty consistent across the whole country. So you have a disincentive for smaller new generators to come into the market because they're basically trying to generate at the same time that all the other wind players are, right? And when the wind's not generating and the wholesale market price is high because that wind's all dropped out, you can't generate just because of physics, because there's no wind, right? So what they'll be looking for is sort of they'll suggest things like, I would imagine, and I'm speculating they may not do this, but I would suggest that they'll follow international models and they'll try and introduce things like contracts for difference, which essentially sets a price, minimum price for the power that the wind farm generates, and all wind farms will get paid that amount regardless of what the market price is doing. So it could be, say, $200 a megawatt hour or something, right? And if the market is only paying $100 a megawatt hour, then they'll get topped up to that 200 megawatts for any power they generate. If it's above 200 megawatts, then they pay that back to the whoever's managing it. So it could be the system operator or the New Zealand Stock Exchange or whoever's managing that. But it's always skewed, right? So there's always more top-ups than there is paybacks, right? So it becomes a subsidy. And what you'll see if you follow the history of this in other jurisdictions around the world is that the strike rate, which is what they call it, or the contract for difference rate, it's always going up each time, and they can't get bids for blocks or areas, permit areas for wind farms unless they keep ratcheting the price up. They won't get the bids until they. So it's getting more and more expensive, is basically what I'm saying. The other one is this curtailment pricing, which is basically they pay you to switch off. So they say, hey, we've got too much power in the system today because there's too much wind. So we have to pay you not to generate. The UK is a great example of that. I think they paid over £220 million pounds of curtailment pricing last year. Just to have people not generating from their wind farms, basically, because they couldn't transport the power.
And in effect, the consumers will pay for all of that anyway. Is
Yeah.
that how it works?
They call it a government subsidy or something, but government doesn't have any money, right? They've only got our money. So, so it is. It's all subsidies and it's all mechanisms like that. It just makes it expensive. It's got all sorts of hidden costs and things like that, which, yeah.
So we go back to one of your key points is around this energy density, and why do we need to be more concerned about getting the right sort of energy? The better the higher the density, as I understand it, and I'm a simple man understanding what you write. I hope I've got it right, that the better the energy density, generally the lower cost it would be. But we seem to be going for energy systems that are with wind and solar that aren't that energy dense. Have I got that right?
So yeah, exactly. So if you look at the history of energy additions, not transitions, because we never transfer away from something, we just add more. We've gone from something like wood, which has about a 5 to 1 energy, just wood that you cut down a tree and chuck it in a fire, it's sort of 5 to 1. And then we've gone to coal, which is closer to 30 to 1, could have been as high as 50 in the early days. And then we've brought in oil, which is similar sort of range to coal. Gas is a little bit better on top of that. And then you get into things like nuclear, which is, I think, something like 10,000 to 1 or something. So each time we're going to a higher energy density, which means we get a higher rate of return. So it's, if you think of it like investing money, you invest $1 in wood and you get $5 back. Or you invest $1 in coal and you get $30 back, so each time you're looking for something with a higher rate of return, and that rate of return manifests as surplus, and the surplus is what we can do the extra work with, which is what grows the economy, produces the lifestyles that we're used to living. It's an old example, but one barrel of oil, for example, is about the equivalent of 4.5 years of manual labor, just in
Yeah.
terms of energy. So you can see like the value that that provides in terms of of our lives. I mean, you've only got to go out and watch someone with a 20-ton excavator, right? Which is, I don't know how much diesel it's burning a day, maybe 150 liters, maybe 200. But the amount of material that thing can move is phenomenal. And that's the sort of work that we get from a higher energy density system. So where we're heading at the moment is we're trying to introduce energy systems that have a lower rate of return than the thing that they're allegedly going to replace. And that's kind of like getting a worse return on your investments in the bank, if you like. So it's not going to be supportive of growth economically. And it really runs a risk if we drag down the productivity of our energy system too much, we're not going to be able to service debt, and we'll basically collapse the economies. More thoughts on that? Yeah, I mean, I can't claim that idea as my own. It's something I've been thinking about and studying quite a lot in the last year or so, and from a few other people who've been writing on this, but. But yeah, I think it's a relevant point, and when you put it in practical terms and you go, hey, if I have to pay the same amount but I only get half as much work, how can I grow the economy? It's
Well,
really that simple.
look at some of the government statistics and data that I can find. One of those says that in the last 15 years, New Zealand has invested more than $10 billion in renewables. And it says that this investment has been driven purely by economics in the absence of demand growth and government incentives, unlike other advanced economies. We have at the same time been told that from April this year, so in a month from now, your power bills for most consumers will be going up by $10 because last year the Commerce Commission announced that it had agreed to increase revenue limits for the national grid owner, Transpower, and other local line companies because they need new level of investment. The power costs that I remember from 15 years ago to now have steadily gone up. I would say my power bill in the last 15 years has doubled easily. Not talking of the dairy shed, just domestic power. At this same time, I am also looking at data from the IEA, the International Energy Agency. The latest they have is for 2023, which shows that across 70 countries, there is a very clear correlation that the higher the wind and solar in the mix, the greater the energy costs for the consumers. And the IEA data shows that for a country which has no wind or solar in its system, across the board of the 70 countries, wherever you look, roughly energy costs are 12 cents per kilowatt hour. And for every 10% that you load renewables into your grid, you're going to be increasing the power cost by 5 cents an hour. Would you say that holds true for New Zealand as well, Larry?
Proof's in the pudding, right? Like, Tonight, I'm just looking where I am. It's what, $350 a megawatt hour, which is 35 cents
8 cents.
a kilowatt hour, which is more than my contract rate on my power bill. So you can see it's going to go up again, right?
And it's going to go up again.
Yeah.
And they keep telling
So,
us,
but I
you are.
also, coming back to the productivity thing, I think we need to have a little bit of a carve out here around renewables, because renewables covers too much, right? So if we look at geothermal and we look at hydro, which have quite unique characteristics in that they're low emission, but they're also dispatchable and you can regulate them to follow load, right? So as a renewable source, those two are excellent, right? I can't recommend them enough. You know, they've got a lot of scope in New Zealand and a lot of potential. And I think New Zealand's history as a developed nation rides largely on the back of, you know, hydro schemes that have been developed over the years because they're just so productive.
Right.
You have the dry year problem,
Absolutely.
but you know what I mean? Like they're not the same as wind and solar, which have a lot of challenges.
And so the IEA's data was not talking about hydro, it was talking about wind and solar. That each time you add wind and solar, every 10% that you added to your grid, you're adding 5 cents per
Yeah,
kilowatt
well,
hour to your power bill. So
intermittency is expensive. You have to have 100% backup, really, right? Like there are going to be times where you've got no wind and no sun, and in those times you need to have something else, right? But it's like anything where you have to have something else, but you're not using it much. You've still got to pay to maintain it. You've still got to have people there to operate it. You've still got, you know, just the general cost of having that asset is there. Depreciation is what I was thinking of. So you've got all of those things are there, but you're not using it as much because now you've got this intermittent source that comes and goes all the time, right? But you've also got all that infrastructure and all that CapEx tied up and all of that maintenance and all of that operating. So now you've got two parallel systems that you've both got to maintain, which is why it starts to cost more. And the overall productivity of the system comes down as a result of that. Which is
none of
why,
us is sounding very hopeful.
yeah, no, it's a big challenge, right? Like, I mean, everyone just looks at the fuel source and they say the fuel is free, but essentially all fuels are free. It's just the infrastructure you need to harness them.
How you
That's,
harness that.
yeah.
But going right on back, Larry, in my view, and I'll probably get into trouble for saying this and get a barrage of comments, but if it wasn't for the nonsense of the Paris Accord or the Kyoto Protocol of 1998 or 2000, this big push for decarbonisation, we would have slowly transitioned to whatever it has to be in a more orderly sense. Currently, it seems quite disorderly because of the edict that you must transition away from the fuel sources you've had. And you know, New Zealand was already at a very in a very good place, but we've made it harder for ourselves and more costly. And on the way through, we've fed a whole lot of people with a lot of work effectively by changing the market, you know, the mix of our energy source to add these wind and solar things. None of it comes cheap.
Yeah, and I mean, hey, like when you looked at it in the initial stages, when there wasn't much of it, and it was just a very, very small part of the grid, it looked pretty good actually. You know, the economics looked okay. You know, the grid could cater to the ins and outs of it without any real problems. It's just as you get more and more of it, it starts to skew that equation. So, you know, we're starting to follow the pathway of other nations that have gone further in front of us, and we're starting to experience some of the issues that they've seen, which is,
Yeah, and it could have been so different had we just been New Zealand for New Zealand and forgotten about the world political dynamic around climate,
Net
for
zero.
instance. Net zero. So here we are, but yeah, we're doing our best. Hey, do you have a lot of support for how you're presenting your case? I mean, we've had Brian Leyland on RCR, and he's got his views, and they're not dissimilar. But it's very hard when you look at reports from consultants that are consulting for the industry, and I know you're a consultant. There doesn't appear to be everything meshing here yet. Do you think it will mesh where you can actually say, "Yeah, look, this is the advice we need to give to the Parliament. This is the investment we need. This is the security we need." And let's get on with it. I mean, on top of just the, we're talking electricity tonight, I'm very concerned about our liquid fuels security in this country. Whether I'm right on that or not, I don't know. But we don't seem to have this common purpose apart from this hell-bent mission to decarbonize.
Yeah, so I mean, we always the way I try and present things, and it's just a hobby, Don. I just write these things just because
Yeah, well, it's great.
I just
Great you
want to
do.
put the, I just want to put it out there to people and try and help people develop a little bit of energy literacy, decode some of these things they see in the paper, that sort of thing. But when you've got to put the widest possible lens on these things, and we get boxed into talking about electricity all the time, but electricity is just a small piece of the bigger picture, you know. Like, I think it's only about 40% or something of New Zealand's total energy demand. And we need to look at the bigger picture, which is, like you say, liquid fuels, solid fuels, gas for industrial processes, not for, for heat generation, not for electricity generation, those sorts of things. We've got vulnerabilities starting to appear everywhere. There's geopolitical vulnerabilities with all of the imported fuels. So that's your diesel, your petrol, your jet fuel, all those sorts of things. And we don't have a lot of storage. I think I can't remember what it was, but it's something like 90 days. I think I wrote an article on that recently as well. It wasn't a huge amount of storage. It all comes out of one geographical location in the world, which is around Singapore, which is a bottleneck for China's oil. So any sort of moves against China would indirectly affect us. You
It's
need
a
to
very
be
moving situation,
geopolitical
dynamic.
strategist. Yeah.
One last thing I really want to ask you, because it's been in the news over this last week. Minister Shane Jones talking about deep geothermal energy extraction. And I'm not sure how that works, because there's talk of us having huge pools of geothermal potential that could be sort of standing for renewables. And I, at the same time, we are also out here in Southland. We've had talks about Alpine Falls and how we are sitting in all of these. Reading literature from overseas, I've read talks about black swan events with associated with deep drilling. Do you have any opinion on this, Larry? Don't want to put you on the spot, but thought I'd ask you since we have you here.
Well, deep geothermal's not that deep. It's deep by geothermal terms, but it's not super deep by normal drilling terms. Basically, it's quite a cool concept. Basically, all you're doing is you drill down on one side of a rock formation that you can fracture, that has a lot of heat, and then you drill on the other side of it, and you basically pump water down one side, and it moves its way through the fissures that you've created by fracking it, and gets hot. And comes up this side as steam, essentially, and then you roll a turbine with it. You condense it back to water, and you pump it back down again. So in a big circle. So you're not depleting a geothermal reservoir, essentially, which is why it's quite it's got people quite excited. So, but again, I put a caveat on that in that every time you have to do something, like you have to pump water down, and then you have to recover it as condensate and get it ready to pump it down again, it's more cost to the system, right? So it's more energetic cost to the system,
Energy density then.
which will lower the overall energy return on energy invested. So it's the EROI of the schemes I've looked into so far, and I was planning to write on this a few months ago, but I haven't got around to it, it was lower than conventional geothermal, right? So it's probably got a longer lifespan, and it's more reliable, but it will have a lower productivity than what we're currently getting from geothermal.
Right.
Yeah, so it's not a silver bullet, but it's definitely something to add to the arsenal, and it would be better than intermittency.
Right.
Okay. Well, it looked all scary when we read about it, didn't it, Jaspreet? It looked terribly scary, the way it was presented and some of the stuff you and I read. So great to have a little bit of insight into it. Hey, we're going to have to wrap this, but I just reiterate to our listeners and viewers to go to Larry's Substack, New Zealand Energy. And yeah, Larry puts stuff in simple form for people like You and me,
Oh.
Jaspreet, and we really appreciate it. And of course, one thing we're all watching, Larry, and thank you for putting up the graph about our lake storage, our water hydro storage, Friday week ago. Look, it's something we'd be better all be wary of because it's looking quite as if
No.
it's trending south rather than where we need it to be for this time of the year. So we'll watch you with interest and watch your output. So I'm sure you'll be updating us on it. So thanks for coming back on Power Talk tonight. And that's number two. I'm guessing we're going to have number three, four, and five. But in the
Yep,
meantime,
certainly.
thanks again.
Thank you,
Yeah,
Larry.
no problem. Thanks, guys. It's good to try and get people talking about this, and yeah, I appreciate it.